Welcome to Let's Talk About Obesity Care, a podcast series from Let's Go. The series is focused on thought-provoking and informative conversations to support medical providers interested in obesity prevention and treatment. I'm your host, Carrie Gordon, a pediatric nephrologist turned childhood obesity treatment physician. I am a clinical advisor to Let's Go, a childhood obesity prevention program of the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, and a practicing specialist at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program in lovely Portland, Maine. Today, we're talking about management of dyslipidemia in patients with obesity with Dr. Michael Dedekian. I'm so happy to welcome him to join us today. He's a pediatric endocrinologist at Maine Medical Center with expertise in general endocrinology, diabetes, childhood obesity, and lipid disorders. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Carrie. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back to join us a second time. Well, why don't we start just by talking about the screening recommendations for cholesterol in childhood? Why would we want to screen for elevated lipids in kids, given that we know they're not commonly having heart attacks and strokes during childhood?
We always, as pediatricians, love to look into the future. I guess any physician loves to look into the future and try to prevent disease before it happens. So there's no better time to do that than in kids. So for young children, if we can identify potential risk factors for cardiovascular disease, meaning heart attacks and strokes down the line, then we'd love to be able to find that and do something about it early on, before blood vessels start to get clogged up. So the current guidelines are that all kids between age 9 and 11 should have an initial screening set of cholesterol labs done. And then again, once they reach the end of adolescence, 17 to 18, they should have another set done. And the reason for that is that during adolescence, during puberty, lipid levels can actually fall a little bit. There's a natural little bit of a decline. And so we don't want to be screening 13 and 14 year olds for the first time with lipids, because you may be falsely reassured that everything is okay when there may be something there. So 9 to 11, and then again in older teenagers is when people should be screening. It's been not without controversy when those recommendations came out, but that's what the screening should be. Another reason for that, and you know, years ago, some listeners may remember, we relied more on family history. And if you just rely on family history as a tool to figure out who should need screening, you miss a lot. Sometimes because family history is not known. Sometimes it's simply the parents are still too young to know if there's going to be early cardiovascular disease. You know, many of our parents are 20s and 30s, and they may be too young for us to know if there's going to be family history. So that's why National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute and AAP recommends those screening criteria.
And there is some evidence that there are actually vascular changes during childhood when you have dyslipidemia, correct?
Yes, absolutely. So that's been known for a long time, famously in Beluga heart study data, and cadaveric observations that were made as far back as the Vietnam War and even before then. We know that atherosclerosis starts in young people.
Well, let's start talking a little bit about management. So management of individuals with elevated cholesterol, I think we usually want to start with a lifestyle change, just like we do when we're treating obesity, things like what people are eating and how they're moving and, you know, trying those things for a set period of time and then repeating levels. So when you see kids with elevated cholesterol in your clinic, do you do this all yourself or do you use partners like dietitians or any exercise partners?
Partners are always good, no question about it. So where partners are available and can help us on the behavioral health side and on the nutrition side with working with registered dietitians is always our best bet. There's no question about that. There's two main things we see with lipid problems in kids. The two most common diagnoses that I see are kids who have familial hypercholesterolemia, and that's referring to elevations in LDL cholesterol. Those are most correlated with future cardiovascular disease risk. And then we have kids with high triglycerides. So a different form of cholesterol. It's a different number, as people know, in your cholesterol profile. And that most often correlates with obesity. So the most common dyslipidemia of obesity is high triglycerides with a low HDL, often with normal LDL. So what we do with lifestyle intervention depends a lot on which lipid problem a child has. Elevated LDL is mostly genetically mediated. You definitely can make some inroads with changes to diet, but the impact of diet has its limits. So we want to make sure we're reducing saturated fat. All the sort of common knowledge now, or common knowledge for a lot of people, about the things you don't want to be eating for heart reasons: fried foods, high saturated fat, red meat, full fat dairy, all that kind of stuff. That's high in saturated fat that we know. So you can make some impact on LDL by cleaning that up. But in my experience, it's really quite limited with LDL what you're going to get from diet modification, unless a kid is eating hot dogs three meals a day, you know, which we occasionally see. If there's something really obvious like that, yes, you're going to make some gains. But most kids don't have a ton of horrible saturated fat in their diet. We can make a little bit of an impact, but often if that LDL number is in the 180s, 190s or above, they're going to need a medicine typically to help them out. That compares very much to high triglycerides. So should we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, actually that was where I was going to head next, is like exactly what you said. In my clinic where I'm seeing children with obesity, when I see abnormalities, that's exactly what I usually see, is that high triglyceride level with the low HDL, and oftentimes the LDL is normal.
Right, exactly. So unlike LDL, with triglyceride, food intervention has unlimited potency. There's a large genetic component to elevations in triglycerides as well. There's a number of different genes that control our triglyceride levels, and the combination of genes you have will make you more or less susceptible to having high triglycerides. But in your average child or adult with obesity and insulin resistance, you can make a major impact on that triglyceride level just with diet. And as probably the most important thing I'll say this whole podcast, is that high triglycerides in a child with obesity or an adult with obesity is a fantastic marker of insulin resistance. It's better than sending an insulin level, which we don't usually recommend for screening purposes. So high triglycerides plus obesity usually means there's an insulin resistant state. And the best way to reduce insulin resistance is getting rid of carbs or lowering carbohydrates, making those carbs low glycemic and healthy, and physical activity. So the thing, you know, we get back to the staples of the things we know about healthy eating and exercise. You and I have had a patient in the past who had an unrelated kidney disorder and needed transplantation. And this young child, he was around 8 or 9 years old. He had very, very high triglycerides into the 800 to 900 range. They can get a lot higher than that, of course, but his were pretty high. And there was a lot of angst around transplanting him, because high triglycerides are inflammatory. And there was concerns that he wouldn't do as well post-transplant with levels that high. He came to our wellness clinic. He was engaged with endocrinology. They had dietitian support. There was a lot of psychosocial stressors, and we couldn't get the triglycerides down. And the family felt they were doing everything they could to try to limit his carbohydrate intake, but he needed a transplant. So we decided together to bring this child to the hospital and try to get the triglycerides down. And we had a debate about whether we should prescribe a certain kind of diet for him to get them down, whether we should limit his carbohydrate or what we should do. And what we landed on was we would just do nothing, that we would just bring him to the hospital and let him order off the regular menu. And that alone, because portions were regulated and meals were only three times a day, that alone in about 72 hours reduced his triglyceride level from 800 something to near normal. So
that's incredible.
It's a we had evidence to support that that is what our observation should have been. So that's studied. And so highly potent treatment is reducing carbohydrate, particularly refined carbs, particularly fructose, you know, high fructose corn syrup containing type of things. You can impact it in an incredible way. And we see this not uncommonly. Just this week, I have another young kid struggling with weight who probably has quite a genetic predisposition to high triglycerides. His levels were in the 1,000 to 2,000 range. The families had more success on their own modifying his diet. And we just checked his levels. They were 120 something. So essentially down to normal for triglycerides, just with dietary intervention alone. So there are medicines we use them rarely in kids with triglycerides. Diet is the key.
And do the medications work as well anyways? I mean, I know sometimes you use like Lovazza, right?
We sometimes will use Lovazza. The, the data around the omega-3s is not without controversy. We sometimes will use a fibrate type of medicine as well if we need to. And those can be effective. But like most medicines we use in the insulin resistance and obesity sphere, they work the best when there's ongoing modification to the food intake and activity.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you started talking a little bit about some of the different medications. I know when I was in nephrology, because we had, you know, sometimes resistant nephrotic syndrome, it wasn't unusual to have cholesterol problems in some of our patients. And of course, all the steroids we had to use with transplant. I got pretty comfortable with statins, but I really didn't have much experience, have much experience using some of the other medications. And, you know, when I've read about them, things like using some of the other, you know, like fibric acid or the bile acid resin, sometimes you can have more symptomatic side effects, right? GI side effects from some of those medicines.
Yep. Sometimes you can. They can be a little more common than with the statins, which are usually very well tolerated in kids. And to be honest, I don't feel like I have a ton of experience with those medicines either. We use them so rarely, because usually we can get to target with other interventions, fortunately. So, and there's always exceptions. I mean, we have kids with rare genetic disorders who have very high triglycerides or hyperchylomicronemia syndrome, LPL deficiency, things like that we occasionally see. So those kids need other types of interventions, some of which paradoxically are they need more carbs and less fat in their diet, depending on the genetic defect, but those kids are few and far between, sometimes presenting with pancreatitis, the ones that have very elevated triglycerides.
And I'm not sure, do you get into, you know, increasing dietary fiber? Is that something you leave to the dietitians? I don't know. How much of that stuff do you do yourself in clinic?
Yeah, I think that's always part of our advice. And I think just stemming from 5-2-1-0 type of counseling that we do with families, the increase in fiber intake is inherent with that. If we need to get really specific about grams of fiber, or we have a kid who's a very picky eater, then yeah, I definitely lean on our dietitians to help us more with that.
And I know that the recommendations say you can check fasting or not fasting, just because I hate drawing labs. I mean, kids, so many kids hate getting needles anyways. If you have if you have high levels and someone is not fasting, you end up repeating it, right? I mean, you wouldn't treat based on only non-fasting levels, or would you?
Correct. Yeah. It depends a little bit what the result is. So non-fasting is okay as a first pass for screening. You know, if you have a non-fasting triglyceride level that's 500, I think you have the information that you need to help give the family some advice about lifestyle. If we're on the fence, or you have a number that's more mildly elevated and you're not sure if you need to initiate treatment with a medication, then often we'll repeat with a fasting number. So in my experience, though, usually if you're at the point you need to treat, that number for both LDL and triglycerides is going to be so high that the non-fasting tells you that you have a problem. And then once treatment is initiated, then usually I'll go ahead and do a fasting level for assessment, especially if someone's on a statin.
And I think, you know, looking at the treatment guidelines, I have, you know, charts and tables pinned up. It's one of those things that I think it's really, for me, been difficult to memorize because your treatment levels range might change a little bit based on family history. If you have hypertension or how severe your obesity is, if you have a patient with obesity, I was thinking as we were scheduling this, you must be doing some e-consult with this because this is such a great example of something you could probably help out with if you could look at the whole picture and send a recommendation back.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we just got started with e-consults over the past year. So these are kids who the primary care physician feels might not need a face-to-face visit with a specialist, but they still want formal advice that's documented appropriately. So we have done a number of those for lipid disorders, and it can be a great use of an e-consult. So yes, that definitely can work for a lot of families. And you're right, the threshold to treat under current guidelines is based on whatever else is present in terms of medical problems and family history. So the threshold is a little bit different depending on the child. And that gets a little complicated. So I think it's a great idea to have something taped to the wall that has the algorithm there. One of the resources that's great, there's tons of publications on this, obviously, up to date in this particular area, I think does a really nice job. And my colleague at Boston Children's, Sarah DeFerenti, who's the preventative cardiologist there running their lipid program, she authors that work and has a nice summary there that is a great guide for clinicians.
Well, I think this was really helpful. And I'm really glad you brought up, you know, there are occasions where you see a level where you feel like, okay, this is something we need to treat more aggressively right away, like a really high LDL, you know, giving family the sense that making dietary changes is going to make a big difference when the evidence doesn't really suggest it. That's going to bring them down to where they need to be. It could be pretty frustrating for them. And I also think it's pretty exciting when you think about these really high triglycerides in some patients, that if you're able to find a way to facilitate dietary change and activity change, you know, work on that insulin resistance, that you can really make a big dent in it.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. And that's the most common thing that we see. So, which is also encouraging, you know, so there's good treatment that's there and very achievable. And I think what's also nice is families don't have to be perfect either. We see a lot of improvement in triglycerides with even modest efforts to improve the diet and reduce carbohydrates. So that's encouraging as well.
Well, this was great. I think it's super helpful to have these kind of conversations, and I'm sure the listeners will appreciate it. And I know you're on call. I'll let you get back to it. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Great. Thanks a lot. Happy to do it.
Thanks for listening to Let's Talk About Obesity Care. You can find all of our episodes on your podcast app and on our webpage, letsgo.org. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd really love to hear from you. Please email us at info@letsgo.org. Let's Talk About Obesity Care is produced by Let's Go, with technical support from Maine Health Educational Services. Thanks so much for joining us.